Hey folks, it's me, Ben Blacker, the creator and host of the Writers Panel. Thank you for listening to this really great episode today. Before we get to that, I want to urge you to come out if you're in Los Angeles or to stream either live or on demand our next Retrospects show, which is on May 19th, 2024. It's a really fun show. It's a benefit for the Green Envelope Fund, which provides small grants for entertainment industry workers across the board. Anyone who needs it can apply for these grants. They were instrumental during the strike, and they remain instrumental during these hard times of finding work. So that show, in Retrospects, we do live readings of scripts that were written of existing shows from early in writers' careers. We've done a couple of shows already. They've been tremendously fun. We did a Girls by Bridget Munoz-Leibovitz. We did a Big Bang Theory by Helen Chang. We did a West Wing by Mark Guggenheim. Unbelievable casts that we've had so far, including folks like Debbie Ryan, Sherry Cola, John Ross Bowie, Jim Beaver. Like just bananas casts playing roles that they love and that you love to see other actors play on TV. Anyway, this May 19th show is going to be so much fun. We're doing a Seinfeld and a Succession script. The Seinfeld is written by our friend David Iserson, who wrote the co-wrote the terrific movie The Spy Who Dumped Me and who was a writer for New Girl. He wrote this Seinfeld when he was a teenager, and it's still fun. He nails the voices. The other script is Succession, which is written by the artist known as Fake Carol Lombardini, who made a name for themselves during the strike with this Twitter feed, Fake Carol. The Succession spec that they wrote takes place during the strike. Carol Lombardini is a character in the script. It is so good. It's so funny. They nail all of the voices of Succession, and we are lucky to have just incredible cast for this show. So May 19th, benefit for the Green Envelope Fund, come out to the Elysian Theater. We'd love to see you there if you're in LA. It's an afternoon show, 2 to 4 p.m. Reasonable for grown-ups who don't want to kill their morning or their evening. And if you are not in LA or if you can't make it, please buy a ticket to stream the show. You can live stream it or you can watch it for up to a week after the show. All of the details for tickets are elysiantheater.com, E-L-Y-S-I-A-N theater.com. Or you can also just go to my Substack, go to benblacker.substack.com, and I'll be posting all the details there as well as ticket links and everything. Thanks so much for listening. Hope to see you at one of these shows. And if you are at one of these shows, please come say hello. I always love to meet folks who know the podcast. Thanks for your support.
They write, they talk, and talk about what they write. Tune in tonight, or whenever the time is right. It's the Writers Panel with Ben Blacker, and it's starting now. Oh, yeah!
Don McKellar is here. Don is the co-creator of the new show, The Sympathizer. But Don, tell folks where they have seen your name and your face on their television and movie screens in the past.
Yeah, I act and I direct. So I mean, if you're in Canada, you've seen me for a long time because I was on a show many years ago that I created called Twitch City. I did a movie I directed called Last Night. I've made a bunch of movies up there. And I've acted in Canadian shows. I acted in a show called Slings and Arrows that a lot of Americans know, where I played a horrible director. And I act in movies. I've acted in a bunch of David Cronenberg movies and Adam McGowan movies. And I've made other shows. I wrote a Broadway musical called The Drowsy Chaperone with my colleagues. You know, I've got a very unusual career. It's all over the map. So
it seems like you are a guy who just loves to make things. Is there a difference that goes on in your brain between, you know, directing and writing and even acting for that matter? Like, or is this creative process just all one big process for you?
Well, that's a big question. I mean, early on, I loved the movies. And I was fascinated with them as a kid. But I grew up in Toronto, Canada, and I didn't think becoming a film director was a viable career plan. It just, I didn't know people. There was Cronenberg and people, but I didn't really know. Every famous director from Canada goes to the States, and it didn't seem like a path that I could take. I did think career, theater was a possibility. And fortunately, I had parents who took me to a lot of stage shows. And so I founded a children's theater company in high school to pay my way through university. And so for early on, I was writing and directing and acting, and all those disciplines became jumbled in my mind. And I grew up in a theater scene where we did experimental theater, and a lot of it grew out of group improvisation. And so, you know, that was sort of the one of the big processes at the time. And that is a kind of actor, writer development world. So, yeah, I really have a hard time separating them. That combined with, I think, my attention deficit disorder and sort of curiosity. I know myself well enough to know that I sort of thrive when I'm thrown in deep water and territory that I shouldn't be in, and I have to sink or swim. So I like those challenges, and I think that I need them in a way. I need them to discipline myself, to sort of push myself. So I think all those things combine for this very unusual career that bounces all over the place.
I think that's a really interesting way in. And I want to talk about some early stuff, and we'll get to the sympathizer in a minute. But like, I know the first time I think I became aware of your name was with 32 short films about Glenn Gould, which you wrote.
Oh, yes. There's that too. I wrote 32 short films and people should Google me. They want to know. I'm not going to give my own.
Absolutely. People should go look it up. But like, you've written a lot of independent movies of the late 90s, early 2000s that I think, you know, when there weren't a lot of those movies around, you know, movie lovers sought them out and so got to know your name. I want to talk about like that breaking into features in the first place. And where was your writing career? Was it, you know, going along the same rails as your acting career at the time? Or was this like a conscious choice to divert attention to that?
I mean, I think it was conscious. I mean, it really happened pretty organically. I can't say that I chose my career path or had planned in any way. But I do think I consciously, I mean, just for lifestyle reasons, just my personality, writing is generally pretty solitary unless you're with a room, but even then you're by yourself a lot and you don't get a lot of perks or love from acting. You know, you waltz onto the set, you're pampered, and then you walk away and it's all over. It's so fast. That's what the great thing, you know, from the director's side, I'm jealous of that so much that you can just leave. But writers and directing, you know, you have a certain kind of power, which is wonderful. But I mean, they all have their own powers and their own advantages, all these different disciplines. And they do, I do think they feed into each other. I feel like having experience, I always think acting is a fabulous thing for writers to do. I think that's well known. Directing is valuable too, because you know, it helps you discipline your writing when you know what you would do in an editing room. So, I mean, I think they all do feed each other. I think there's a lot of artificial barriers between the disciplines. I will say that show running finally is a synthesis of all those things. I really feel, you know, I ran this with Park Chan-wook, and we all did. We really did do both things, everything. But I really felt, okay, as a showrunner, my experience as an actor is really valuable, guiding. We had a lot of fairly inexperienced actors that I could help and guide and talk in a way that I don't think a lot of writers or directors would feel comfortable doing. Some would, of course, I'm not bragging, but you know what I mean? Like I felt, okay, that training really is helping me feel, empathize with them and know what would help them. And at the same time, I always feel that when you're writing, I think it was once years ago, I talked to Alan Rudolph, the writer, you know, and he said, all that he thinks about when he's writing is, will an actor like it? And I thought, oh, that's such a Hollywood thing, you know, because it's all about marketing the thing and how to attract stars, which is true. But it's also pretty smart advice because when you're writing something that an actor would like, it usually has rich subtext and stuff to play, and you know, actors know what works. So having that knowledge is valuable, you know, and it really is a good filter to put a script through, thinking, will an actor like this? And this was, this show, The Sympathizer, is so performative. And you know, we had someone like Robert Downey Jr. and it's like, I gotta give him stuff, you know, I gotta show him off. So I think that skill helped too.
I'm coming back to this idea of sort of throwing yourself into the deep end, and taking a chance, not doing the easy project. Is The Sympathizer that for you? How did it come to you?
Oh, it was deep. It was very deep, the water. I mean, yeah, it came to me as a book. And yeah, for sure, I thought, oh my God, I'm not the right person for this. It's about Vietnamese refugee experience in the 70s. 70s, maybe I was right for it because of my age, but the rest of it, not so much. So, but Viet, the author of the book, had said to Kim, a Vietnamese producer who acquired the rights, he said that he was inspired a lot by Park Chan-wook, and that was his dream director. And as it happened, I'd written a script with Park Chan-wook, a feature script. And he had just come off a TV series, The Little Drummer Girl, which was very difficult for him. So I think he was really attracted to the idea of this co-showrunner model, just to bear some of the weight, because he knew how taxing it was. And, you know, also, again, because there's the English component, and he wanted someone who, you know, be able to talk to studio and things like that. So that's how it started. And I felt, yeah, I do identify with this book. I do connect with it, even though it's not my community's story, but I'm able to connect with it. And I do, I am moved by it personally. So I think I can translate this to the world outside the Vietnamese community. I can be helpful to it. And combined with Park Chan-wook, we have this sort of co-showrunner with two faces. We formed this entity, I think, that can tell the story well. But it was terrifying. It was really terrifying for me, for sure.
So how do you, well, tell me what was terrifying specifically. I mean, I think you've described sort of the entirety of it being fairly terrifying.
I hope that most of your listeners will understand what would be terrifying. First of all, it's a Pulitzer Prize winning book, right? It's always scary to have a famous book because people have expectations. The book is fame. If it wins a literary prize, it's because it's as good as a book, you know, and it's accomplished in literary, you know, it satisfied the needs of the medium. And now you're translating it to another medium, and you're, in the majority of cases, you know, the book suffers. It's lesser than the book. And there's the old, I think, Hitchcock adage that it's better to take, you know, a pulp fiction and turn it into a great movie than the reverse. And I feel, so there is that, you know. But this book, I tried to calm myself by saying that it's not a reflective musings. You know, this book is full of incidents. It's full of stories. It's about storytelling. It's very pop cultural savvy. It's playful in a way. It's not Proustian or something, you know, like, you know what I mean? It's very propulsive read. It's full of incidents. So I thought, yes, many of these look like set pieces, some of these chapters I could easily see translated onto the film. And in fact, I was excited right from the beginning, along with the terror, with translating a lot of those things. So there's that. And there's the scope and the scale. There's speaking for a community. There's figuring out how to be respectful to the Vietnamese language. That half of the script is Vietnamese or more, spoken in Vietnamese. So there were a lot of scary things. There was the idea of working with Robert Downey Jr., which was scary for sure. When he first wanted to meet with me, I was pretty scared. So,
I mean, honestly, that would be true of like people who are working with Park as well, and people working with you. I mean, like, don't sell yourself short.
It's funny because people are very intimidated by Park Chan-wook. He does have something about him. It's partly that he doesn't speak English and everything has to be translated. But also he does have this very assured air, and he's sort of revered. For rightfully so, for his work. So you can see when I was first working with him on a feature script, I met him in his hotel room. He came to Toronto for us to work together, and it was through his translator, and who always called him Director Park. So early on, I would say, Director Park, do you think it would be interesting, things like that? And at one point, he sort of laughed and said, don't call me Director Park. I'm your equal. We're writing together. It's try and call me by my name, Chan-wook. But everyone on the set called him Director Park. So, I mean, yeah. Well, the film set, there's these degrees of terror and intimidation that everyone feels. That's especially here in Hollywood. And overcoming your inhibitions about that kind of stuff is key to a success. You've got to get over it, right?
Yeah, and that's kind of what I want to zero in on here. I mean, you've got, in tackling the sympathizer, all of the things that you've talked about already, right? The weight of expectation, the fear of translation, of representation. How do you push through that stuff to just tell the story, just make the thing you want to make?
Well, it's hard. It's like how to maintain your sanity, right? Like that's sort of a side of writing and especially showrunning that people don't talk about because it really requires analysis, but it's, how to maintain your equilibrium and how to know that you are fighting for something that is valid, because you are always fighting. How do you know that you're fighting for something that is worthy of fighting for and not just some sort of vanity or sort of stubbornness it's really hard. and again, how can you be confident? You've done your research, but you're speaking, for his history. You can back it up. You can have people check, but somehow you've got to be confident that this is true to history. But I don't know. It's like you've got to find, again, it's like, but self-care. It's like, how do you, what puts you at ease? What makes you... what gives you that confidence without being cocksure or without being arrogant, still being open to voices, still being open to dialogue? I mean, at the end, when this still isn't over, but my HBO executives took me out for dinner and said thank you for talking to us about these things and explaining these things, because often writers don't even do that. And I said, well, what do you mean? They said, well, people get entrenched, and they either get threatened by notes. And I would at length explain why I thought something worked or why I thought we could do something or we couldn't do other things. And I was really happy that they appreciated that. I feel like that the worst thing to do is to block yourself and to hold on to something because you're afraid that if someone's other idea will intrude, everything is going to dissolve. So I do believe in that you have to sort of be open to dialogue and both ways. You can't be afraid of hearing great ideas because that's death, but you also can't be afraid of expressing your own ideas to even people who might intimidate you.
I think you've done a great job telling us how to fight, in that it's not a fight.
Yes. You know,
it's a conversation. But this question of, you know, when to take a note or when to hold to your original vision is one that comes up a lot among new writers.
It's very hard.
And they want to know, how do you know? You know, how do you know when your idea, your the piece that you've come up with is the right thing?
I mean, it is very hard, and it's something that writers think about all the time. As a general rule, I will say that younger writers are less experienced writers, are usually more stubborn and usually more entrenched in their thing and more defensive. Just because experienced writers can't afford to be, you know, they know that that's not going to work after a while. But at the same time, you absolutely just can sort of become a hack and lose your voice if you don't fight for what you believe in. For me, it really helps to have collaborators who you trust, who respond to your ideas, you know, like, and I mean, I really did love working with Chen Wu because I completely trust his opinions. I would come to him with ideas, and when I thought it was a good idea in my own office, I would think, this is great. It's a totally Park Chan-wook idea. He's going to love it. And then, which is a great feeling, right? And it's great to write for someone because it kind of affirms, it's not your taste, it's their taste. And then when I would show it to him, if it was good, he would always say, yes, it's good, but what about this? And then whenever he had one of those, what additional things, I thought, okay, I got it. Like, he likes it, you know, like, yeah, he wants it, but he wants to make it even better. It's the best thing you can get for a collaborator. So, I mean, in my career, I've really found finding those people that you trust is really, I always say to people who are floundering with this, that those collaborations are the best way to get your personal taste through. That's why it's not a compromise. It's never a compromise. It's about ensuring that your voice is going to be heard, your personal voice is respected.
How did you and Park work together? Was it different from your usual process?
Well, they're all different, right? Like, this was definitely different because I've worked with writers where we just start with nothing and shoot the shit and write it down. You know what I mean? But I've also, I talked with him a lot at the beginning, sort of conceptual thing, the basic style, or basic sort of narrative devices and the shape of the show. I wrote a pilot and then I arranged the room. We wrote scripts and then he got involved. We had discussions along the way. But then he took it, wrote stuff in Korean. Then that was given to me in translated English. And then I reprocessed that and then gave it back to him. So the actual translation process was almost part of our working process. We both sort of thought through the translation in a way. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's interesting. It's like, and when he would do some things, and I would come back, and I'm not faulting the translator because he did an amazing job, but sometimes I'd think, what is this line? Like, what is he even going for here? And then I would think, oh, I think I know. Like, I think what he's, oh, that's a great idea. You know what I mean? Like, it's not there, but so the sort of distance of translation, I think, allowed space for our imaginations to fill in the gaps. It's a very unique process that isn't going to work most of the time, but I think it really worked. I think he agrees, you know. I recommend that if you have a chance.
Yeah, it's such an interesting process because you're giving yourself a distance from the language and from the emotion, and then you have to find your way back in or find a new angle on it.
Yes, exactly right. Because he would never give me stuff, you know, it's never like, oh, that's perfect. You know, when you work with someone in your language, it's like, I think the line should be like this, but it's not exactly that, right? It's different. It's more like, no, I think something's wrong with it. It should be. Sometimes people say, oh, it should be, shouldn't it be less words and things like that? I say, yeah, you're probably right. You know, like, which is a different way of thinking about it, you know?
And then tell me about working with this writer's room too. How big was the room? Where did you find the writers? What did you read? Like, what material did you read to get to know them?
Let me think. It was 5 writers. It was pretty small by most standards. Plus 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, an assistant. And sort of, we had a special sort of, observer, like a trainee or something. I don't know what her title is. That's probably not it. I'm sure it isn't. She was great too. Sorry about that. It was a program. There's a sort of training program that HBO is part of. And Chen Wu had a spy in the room, his translator, who was taking notes. He didn't participate that much, but he reported back to him in Korean, I assume. And I found them through reading a lot of stuff, mostly. I saw watch stuff too, but you know, it's always hard to tell from, unless they are the sole writer and creator, it's hard to tell sometimes what a writer is contributing based on their on the final product.
In casting the room, though, were you looking for certain strengths? Were you looking for certain personalities? What was on your wish list?
Yeah, I mean, what you look for is you want a viable room with people with different experiences. And of course, I wanted Vietnamese people, and I wanted Vietnamese voices because it's a Vietnamese community. But I didn't exclusively want that. I wanted it to, it's not just about that. It's about the duality. I had many people with different ethnicities and mixed ethnicities. I had a lot of, because they are central characters, half is Eurasian. So, but I didn't base it on race. I also based it on people's, I wanted diversity of writing experience. Like a lot of people wrote plays and came out of theater and wrote really cool plays, and I thought could have different ideas, because I wanted it to be, the show to be in a way about storytelling and a bit about performance. So that seemed valuable to me. It's really hard to say, like, you really, and in your head you're sort of balancing personalities and thinking, oh, they'll spur us on, they'll be funny, they'll contribute. You want to, I think ultimately I interviewed them all, of course, and that's key, because especially because I was doing it remotely, it's like this. You just have to be engaged. You have to be able to engage with each other. And then, of course, you know, my producers got involved and suggested people. Of course, the network wanted people who were, some people that they trusted more with more experience. So everyone had their interests, but it worked really well. Everyone, it's funny, like I didn't have any opposition. They were really happy. Everyone was very happy with my choices. I think, Team Downey got involved, A24, but they all basically made suggestions, and it was a huge amount of work. I hope people know that I really work hard. I'm sure everyone does, you know, like I read so much stuff and did so many reviews and talked to so many people and got references for everyone and talked to showrunners they'd worked with. So people take it really seriously.
Like you want to get that right at the beginning. Otherwise, the show can go off the rails immediately, or you won't have the experience you want to have.
Yes, because there is a sort of magic, right? Like there is a sort of, it's all about this sort of chemistry, and when a room works together, and And, you know, as a showrunner, you've got to lead it. So you don't want to, you don't want it to be a burden, you know, and you don't want to drag a team through the mud. You know, you want to people who can sustain them and on their own, you know. And so I don't know. There's lots. Yeah. I think the thing is the showrunner, you don't want to be, well, that's different for showrunners, but you don't want to be performing for your room. You don't want to say, isn't this great? Aren't I great? Like, this is a great idea. You know, like that's, you want people who have strong enough experience, strong enough voices, are opinionated and intelligent enough that you can't even allow that possibility to happen.
And tell me just from a nuts and bolts perspective, what did you come into the room with? Like, did you have episodes broken? Clearly you had the story because you're coming off of the book, but you knew what you wanted to use.
Well, I came in with the pilot. We already had written the pilot, so that's a lot. And I did basic arc of the series and basic breakdown. Like, I thought, this is where it'll start, this is where it'll end, based on the book, right? We had a book. So I'd talked it through with Viet, the author, too. I said, I decided on 7 episodes, which is a weird shape, but just seemed to naturally fit with the book. And so as it went along, of course, I had fairly strong sense of the shape of the shows before we started. And I guess I would also say we basically did stick to that structure.
Once you're all sort of established in the room and everyone starts to get comfortable, what are your expectations from your writers as you start to build episodes?
Well, you know, at the beginning you try and get, again, because I really feel this show is a lot about the voice and the tone, and it's about different voices. I tried at the beginning, even though there's a lot of pressure to get going, to talk and to play around a bit. We watched some movies. We watched Deer Hunter, which I thought was important because I thought of it as a sort of important text because it's sort of a flip. It's about these three American brothers who go to Vietnam, and our story is sort of about three Vietnamese brothers, blood brothers, who leave Vietnam. So the movie is sort of a critique of American telling of the Vietnam War. And so watching some texts like that seem important, and hearing the response, and that all seemed key to talk about. I brought a lot of music in. I sent them out a song of the day each day. So there's this, you know, you try and keep part of the job is to sort of inspire people, right? Inspire to, oh, that's a cool thing about the time. I didn't know that about 1975, or, you know, that, or about Vietnam, or, and then you try and lean into the individual expertise of your writers sometimes, you know, get them to talk about, because I know, of course, because I interviewed them and I talked to them about their work or their interests, basically why I hired them, you know. And so there's all that. You've got to take your time to do that at the beginning. And then we talked it through, sort of started beating it out, talking about the characters. We talked about, you know, the general things, the things we'd like to maybe tweak from the novel, things that we thought maybe we could emphasize and set some rules for ourselves. And then we did it through, and then eventually I assigned writers to write outlines and we wrote scripts.
Those initial meetings, whether it's, you know, days or weeks of tone setting, are always so much fun to me and so interesting to me. Is this, as a director, is this something that you are able to do at the beginning of production too?
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. I mean, not as much as you'd like, but I, it really is important to get people on the same page, especially for this show that has a kind of show like this, that has a sort of quixotic kind of tone. Like, it's a very unusual tone, and a lot is dependent on that working. And Viet said right from the beginning, it's all about the tone of the voice. And I think that that's true, because it's sort of mixture of tragedy and satire and sort of surprising cruelty juxtaposed to sort of heartbreak is really hard to do. And it's very dense. There's tons of stuff. And we all wanted to keep it very compact. There's almost so much stuff happening that you have to pay very close attention. And so we wanted to really feel like these shows were tightly wound. And all that requires preparation, you know. It requires everyone being on the same team and playing by the same rules. And, you know, of course, I also brought Chanuk in, and we grilled him and talked about his work. And
I want to ask you a question about Slings and Arrows, though.
Oh, Slings and Arrows.
And that is, genuinely, this is my own curiosity. Did you take this role? Were you directing already when you took this role?
Yeah, I had been. Yeah, I had done some directing, but I don't think it was a parody of me or anything like that.
No, that's what I wonder about, is like creating that character based on experience, based on knowledge, and based on like.
I didn't write that piece. My friends did. One of my collaborators, Bob Martin, and I've worked with Mark McKinney too, and Susan Coyne. I mean, we're from the theater community. We'd all obviously had theater community experience. I had a theater company. I knew directors like that. The writers had very specific, I in fact knew the director they had in mind. I'd never worked with him, but I knew him by reputation. So I had my own directors in mind. It's fun. It's a very liberating thing, because people think, oh, that character's so exaggerated. And if you work in the theater, you think, oh, you have no idea. That was the most modest interpretation of that character. So, that was really fun. Like, I knew the writers, and I think, again, they sort of wrote for me, I think, wrote stuff that they knew I could play one of those asshole characters. I played quite often on the stage and things. So, that was really fun. That's a blessing to get that kind of material.
That's a blast. I mean, it seems like throughout your career, you've been lucky enough to work with these collaborators who, you know, understand you, and you can help them to understand what you want to do. And
I've been very lucky. Yeah.
Like, you're looking at your resume as a writer and actor and director, like, it's marked by just people who seem to understand each other and want to make good things.
Yes, and I need a lot of understanding. So it's a sort of miracle.
The Sympathizer is available. We've got 2 episodes out right now on Max, and it's 7 episodes for folks to check out. We'll end, as we always do, by asking what you are watching on television these days. What's getting you excited or inspired? I will also accept movies, plays, anything that's really getting you excited these days.
See, I mean, I wish you told me in advance that this was going to be a thing. I'm trying to watch.
If only I had.
My competitors right now. I'm trying to watch Three Body Problem. I'm trying to watch The Regime. I watch True Detective because my executives, I feel like I have to talk to them about their show, because we were shooting contemporarily. I'm sorry to say that that's sort of a lot of my motivation now, is I got to talk about these things. So I'm not saying that I'm totally inspired. I don't think I like Trinity. I think I have my problems with everything, though. So I'm just picky. So I don't want to say that those, but they all have the value. There's also cool things in all those shows. I don't know. I should have prepared more.
I'm leaving that entire answer in, and we're going to have a picture of you with a shovel just digging your own grave. Don, thanks so much for chatting today.
All right. That was really fun.